Welcome back to the Revelation On Demand podcast, a podcast dedicated to bringing you Revelation from the Bible. I'm your host, Justin D. Myers, and welcome back. Glad to have you back today. Looks like we'll be going over Isaiah 9, which is the next chapter that we have been studying in our Isaiah episodes. So as a release of this, it would have been just after Thanksgiving, so I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving. We had a pretty good one. Hope that you got time to spend with family, or at least people that you love and people that you care for. You got a chance to think about how thankful you are for things in your life. So personally, I'm thankful for my family. I have 5 wonderful children and an amazing wife that I'm very grateful for. My work, which keeps me able to, you know, keep the lights on. Let's me provide for my family in the way that I know best. And then just the real lack of hardship. I mean, we've gone through a few things that are, I would say, are kind of hard, but nothing like I get this way sometimes. I think at my life in this time and place, and then I think back to the way people used to suffer. People even suffer today. Like, it's really hard for me to think I've been through hardship because of that. And of course, after saying all that, another thing that I'm very grateful for is all our listeners. So thank you very much for listening. And again, I hope you had a chance to think about your gratefulness, the things you're grateful for. So continuing on, what happened last episode in Isaiah 8? It was a lot of doom and gloom, where Isaiah brought a terrible prophecy to the king of Israel, Ahaz, and it continued today. So we're going to be getting back into more of that kind of doom and gloom prophecy. And then, of course, Ahaz refused to humble himself last chapter, and we're going to watch Israel do the very same thing. So, things we need to know going into this chapter. The poetry of Isaiah is coming in the coming chapters, blends elements of Thanksgiving and royal psalms to emphasize the Davidic kingship. So we're going to see a lot today that there's talk about the King of David or the Davidic king or the true king that's to come. And of course, this is talking more about Jesus, I believe, than it is talking about Ahaz or anyone at this time. And we'll get into that a little more as we get to that section. In the coming chapters, as we continue on through this study, there'll be more of this language talking about the Davidic kingship, which many believe, points to Christ. Of course, anytime that we're talking about the Davidic line and the king, the true king to come, we of course are in some way talking about Christ, if not always talking about Christ. So with no further ado, let's ado further. Chapter 9. Excuse me, Isaiah chapter 9. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, we humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, he will honor Galilee of the nations by the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You have enlarged your nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you, as people rejoice at the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke of that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle, and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, and us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne, and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from the time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. So Zebulun and Naphtali were two of these states, that were a part of Israel at one point, but also, you know, individual states. And these were the northernmost tribes. So if there was an invasion coming from the big bad Assyria, it would have been coming from this direction. Now, Galilee is being marked here with judgment, but in the future, it would be the gateway for the nations to come to worship God, and as we know, Galilee is the place where Jesus would be born one day. And then the light and the darkness is always a hopeful image. Here's a great light representing God, which often, as we talk more about in this chapter, light is one of the key representations of God. And of course, we're going to get into much darker stuff in this chapter as well, so it's good to have a little bit of light in the beginning to remind ourselves what to look for. So, in the day of Midian, this is referring to an event described in Judges, where a small force of Gideon encircled the Midian camp in the middle of the night, and with trumpets, torches, and clay pitchers, they sent the much larger enemy camp into a frenzy so bad that they began to fight themselves and eventually flee the battlefield. So this is one of those weird war stories from the Bible that where a much smaller force some way creatively disrupts a much larger force. So we're talking about this again because God is going to disrupt this much larger force that Israel has become in much the same way he disrupted the army of Midian. And Ahaz is really the opposite to Davidic king of Isaiah. I think we've talked before that Ahaz is one of the most evil rulers in Israel in the entire Bible. So, you know, it's pretty high up there where he's like the polar opposite of this Davidic king that Isaiah talks a lot about. Now, some people have tried to connect this Davidic king to Hezekiah, which would have been his immediate predecessor. But at the time that Isaiah was writing this or giving these, that son of his, Hezekiah, was already raised. So that casts some doubt on the Davidic king being Hezekiah. More likely, it points towards Jesus and his coming and his being the Davidic king. And another problem is Hezekiah, yeah, had already been born. Sorry. The list of the titles, we talk about Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. These are also like the Almighty God, Everlasting God. That sort of thing is not very applicable to a human king. So this would also cast a little bit of doubt on it being Hezekiah as the Davidic king. And then it finishes out talking about an internal kingdom where it's talking about establishing, upholding with justice and righteousness from the time on and forever. This is very much talking about the eternal kingdom that we see in Revelation, where he's talking about how this eternal kingdom will be established in all God's power and his glory will rain down on it forever. And of course, this would be very, very difficult for a human unless we are apostatizing and saying that this human could become a god. So, very likely not talking about Hezekiah. Sorry, buddy. And of course, being us a, you know, kind of spiritual podcast, we have to stay with the more complete fulfillment of prophecies that we are more interested in. So of course we are going to think that this Davidic king is talking about Jesus is coming. Because again, we talked about how Isaiah is taking part about 400 to 500 years before Jesus was born. So we see that, you know, while Israel has become a very established nation because they were established, you know, 3000 before Christ or something like that, it's becoming this old empire that's going to fall to its knees. And of course we know that Rome comes in and takes over Israel at the point when Jesus comes. So that could have very much been one of those points where Israel is being humbled by another nation because they're not following God the way they should. So continuing on in verse 8, the Lord has sent a message against Jacob. It will fall on Israel. All the people will know it. Ephraim and its inhabitants of Samaria, who say with pride and arrogance of heart, the bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with dressed stone. The fig trees have been felled, but we will replace them with cedars. But the Lord has strengthened Rezin's foes against them and has spurred their enemies on. Arameans from the east of Philistines. Arameans from the east and Philistines from the west have devoured Israel with open mouth. Yet, for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised, but the people have not returned to him who struck them, nor have they sought the Lord Almighty. So here we see God talking about how he's angry with Israel and the fact that they have not decided to return to following God, even though they are being, you know, they're starting to become oppressed by other nations around them. And Israel's pride and confidence in their own abilities is really the root of their sin. That Isaiah is pointing out that they are so arrogant and confident in their own abilities that it doesn't matter what kind of hardships it seems that they befall, that they will always say, you know, oh, we got this. We can do this. We can get through this sort of thing. Now, it's okay when you're saying, yeah, we can get through this because of the Lord. We can do this because of the Lord. But if you're thinking, oh, I can do it of my own accord, I can do it of my own power, that's where the problem is coming in. They think they don't need to worship Almighty God because they can handle the things going on in their life. It's really an arrogance. Now, there's a section in there talking about bricks and then ornate stones or dressed stones. And so bricks would have been, you know, clay and some dry matter that's designed to help the clay hold together better. And stones would be stronger, would be more sturdy, and of course dressed stones would be ornate and look prettier and be much more expensive and much easier or much harder to work with. So it would take even more time to build with ornate stones and dressed stones. So we see that they are thinking about rebuilding everything just of their own power, their own wealth and power. And they will build these structures expecting them not to be destroyed, because if they're willing to put so much resources into these stones that are used for building, it means they don't expect others to come by and you know, destroy or pillage or take over their structures. I mean, it's talking about Rezin and Aram. We've talked a little bit about these. These are the countries that Ahaz has appealed to help them fight against Assyria, but they have been overcome by this great Assyrian army in this, and God is letting Assyria run right up to Israel's front door and bring about the punishment that he sees just for their arrogance and the evil things that they have done. So God doesn't tell evil things to do what they do. They will always seek to destroy and do evil things. However, he can remove and give his protection at will. So if he allows evil things to happen, it means that his protection is removed. Now, this doesn't always mean that you're necessarily being forsaken. Say if you take Job, for example, God removed his protection from Job, and Job faced, you know, some of the most ravaging evils there ever was to be sought or anyone could ever face. And it was not because God was upset with him, it was because God was testing him. So, but in this case, God's upset and he's letting the evil happen because he is letting Assyria be his tool of judgment. Now, even with enemies on every side, Israel remains confident in their security. So, you know, he's talking about Rezin and Aram, which was the countries around them. And again, they have fallen and they're taken over. And of course, they're surrounded on every side now. And they still will not turn to God. And it's Israel's disobedience would this time, as it always has, lead to their downfall. Seems they will have to be brought to their knees before they finally turn back to God. And in this case, to their knees is not enough. It's going to be utter destruction for Israel. There will be almost no Israel left after this destruction. Kind of like the flood scenario where only Noah and his family was left over after this just judgment of destruction. This will be similar to the same. Now, of course, he's not wiping out the entire world. He's just wiping out most of Israel to start over with a new line. So finishing up from verse 14 to the end of the chapter, so the Lord will cut off from Israel both head and tail, both palm branch and reed in a single day. The elders and dignitaries are the heads, the prophets who teach lies are the tail, those who guide this people mislead them, and those who are guided are led astray. Therefore, the Lord will take no pleasure in the young men, nor will he pity the fatherless and widows, For everyone is ungodly and wicked. Every mouth speaks folly. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. Surely wickedness burns like a fire. It consumes briars and thorns. It sets the forest thickets ablaze, so that it rolls upward in a column of smoke. By the wrath of the Lord Almighty, and the land will be scorched, and the people will be fuel for the fire. They will not spare one another. On the right they will devour, but still be hungry. On the left they will eat, but not be satisfied. Each will feed on the flesh of their own offspring. Manasseh will feed on Ephraim, and Ephraim on Manasseh. Together they will turn against Judah. Yet for all this, the anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. I know I've said this a lot, but this is why people don't like reading the prophets. They're very doom and gloom kind of guys. It's really hard to not see this when you see the people that you're supposed to be helping just turning away from God and doing all these things to blaspheme God, basically. And you know what they can do to turn back and have better lives and not go through so much hardship. And it really pains you, you know, to see them making poor choices. And then they wonder why nobody likes talking to them, because all they talk about is the fact that this is all they see. All they see is this darkness, this sin that is causing everyone to turn away from God. So God will judge Israel in one day, like it takes one day for Assyria to destroy Israel and bring God's punishment upon them. As we've talked about before, that one day is that judgment day. Of course, here we have a time where there is a partial and a full fulfillment that this prophecy is talking about. It's talking about the partial fulfillment where Assyria is to destroy Israel and take them under their control and you know, destroy most of Israel. And then, of course, they're also talking about the fulfillment on the final day of judgment, when every nation shall be judged, every person shall be judged, every action shall be judged, and God will sort through those who have stayed faithful and those who have fallen away. And the leaders, of course, here, talking about the head and the tail and the prophets and the leaders, are to bear the blame for misleading Israel. And normally, this would be where the judgment stops. It stops at the leaders. You know, they're the ones who are going to take the brunt of the force. You know, a lot of the people who follow will feel the judgment, but they're not going to be judged in the same way. But in this case, that is not the same. All of Israel will be judged. And then leaders today are held to just as much. They bear the brunt of judgment for those they lead away from God or mislead them in God. We see this today with bad pastors or church leaders or elders that get it stuck in their head that some doctrine, some crazy doctrine or something, and they mislead people or they turn them away from God in some manner. And we can see that. Well, we don't see that yet, but we can know that these people who are leading people astray or leading people from God will face some of the most severe punishments, because they are standing in a place of trust and a place of power and authority. And when they misuse that and they use it to, you know, enrich themselves or just mislead people away from God, they will face even more punishment for that. Not just your everyday Joe who, you know, just believes in God and tries to go about his life doing what God would want him to do and what he can do in his life. So as I was talking about before, normally it's just the leaders who take the brunt of the punishment. But in this case, orphans and widows, the fatherless and the husbandless, aren't getting that same special exemption. But because Israel's offense is so grave and it's happening from the very top to the very bottom of the lowest parts of society, it's even the people who normally get this exemption status from judgment, they too will be judged, because it's not just the leaders who are blaspheming God and trusting in their own power and leading people astray. It is also the people who are following them, who have in their own hearts taken upon themselves not to trust the Lord. Now, of course, as always, there's always a small remnant. Of course, Isaiah is one of them that is living, that is going to make it through this. They're not going to like it. They may not have a very happy time of it. But there will always be a small remnant that God can rebuild from, no matter how fulfilled or how full this destruction is. And it talks about a column of smoke, and this imagery is used through the Bible quite often. It's often to represent God. There was a column of smoke and fire that led Israel out of the desert. And then there's the column of smoke from the lake of fire, and it's talking about his presence. It's most likely either his protection or his judgment. So as in the case of Israel walking through the desert, the pillar of smoke and fire was a sign of protection, a sign of guidance, a sign of, you know, his favor. Whereas in this time where it's coming off of the burning Israel and the one that comes off the lake of fire, much in the same way, this is his judgment. This is his punishment for people not following him as they should. And then it talks about the devouring of the offspring. It's most likely a metaphor. Things can get that rough in wartime that people might start doing this. And I mean, there's plenty of horror stories of people actually doing this, but here it's being used metaphorically to depict that things will get so bad that the people of Israel will turn on each other, that they will not trust one another anymore, and they will fight each other just as willingly as they fight the invaders. And then Manasseh and Ephraim were tribes named after two sons of Joseph. And this is one of those tribes that came from a splitting of a former tribe. And it suggests that there's not going to be any unity left in Israel if these two who came from the same tribe will split and fight each other, then there will be no unity in all of Israel. And it's really, really a cheery note to end today's passage on. So today's takeaway is a little lighter and a little bit, it's looking up. So trust in the Lord for all your strength, power, and wisdom. He will protect you no matter how difficult things may seem. Trusting in our own power will only lead to death, destruction, and desolation. Only God is capable of giving us protection from the evil in the world. That is our own doing. To think anything else is foolish. With that, I'd like to thank you for listening to the Revelation On Demand podcast. Please like, share, and subscribe wherever you catch podcasts from. Please, if you like what we're doing, share this with a friend, family member, or someone from your church. This is a completely private venture and receive no funding from any sources. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns, please feel free to contact me at revelationondemand@gmail.com. God bless, and see you next time.